about Cox. He's certainly allotted a generous amount of time. Expecting a 15-minute talk, I found myself spending close to an hour with the president. But as it developed, he wanted to talk about several other matters, health, the economy. When we did finally get around to the topic at hand, Carter told me bluntly and preemptively why he could never, ever support Cox for the First Circuit. In later years, Carter would claim that it was Cox's age, he was nearly 67 then, that made him an unacceptable choice. That is not the way the president represented it to me in his office. He could never, ever support Archibald Cox, he said, because Cox had supported Morris Udall instead of Carter in the 1976 Democratic primary. I had witnessed a lot of political grudges in Washington, and I knew that though they generally led to punishment of some sort, overt revenge was far from the only means of settling them. I pressed on. Well, that was back then, and you defeated Udall. Cox's support for him certainly does not mean he has no admiration for you. Carter shrugged and said he knew that Cox had been close to the Kennedy family and to Jack in particular, and that made some difference to him, but not enough. Reflecting on this later, I suspected that it made the wrong kind of difference. I then framed the nomination from a political context. Cox, I pointed out to Carter, is the most respected lawyer in the country. Putting him on the First Circuit would be a 10 for you. It would be a 9 for me recommending him, but it would be a 10 for you. Jimmy Carter gave me an icy stare. He said, "Even that isn't going to override my strong feelings against Archibald Cox for supporting Udall." His words had a certain ring that I have always remembered. It seemed as though Carter was experiencing real pleasure in telling me that he was not going to support Archibald Cox. As for the other subjects that we covered, I always felt that he wanted credit for talking to me for an hour, rather than just 15 or 20 minutes, so he could claim to have reached out to me. But whatever his reasons, it was clear he wasn't really interested in my views on Cox. Any thoughts I still held about supporting Jimmy Carter in a re-election bid, I put firmly to rest on July 15, 1979. On that evening, the president appeared on the three major television networks to deliver the most self-destructive address of his administration. Fatigued from the rigors of a recent economic summit in Tokyo, and just before that, a round of touchy negotiations on arms limitations with Leonid Brezhnev, distressed by American outrage over the energy crisis gas lines that had driven his approval ratings down to 25%, and badly shaken by an alarmist memo from his pollster, Pat Caddell, that warned him of a sharp decline in the nation's trust in him, Carter looked into the camera lens and fulfilled Caddell's prophecy. He lectured people of the nation on their contribution to what he called a fundamental threat to American democracy. This contribution, he declared, was a collapse of confidence and of faith in government and in themselves. It is a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will, Carter intoned. We can see this crisis in the growing doubt about the meaning of our own lives and in the loss of a unity of purpose for our nation. The erosion of our confidence in the future is threatening to destroy the social and the political fabric of America. This was the address that would become famous as Carter's malaise speech, although the president did not use that word in his remarks. It had appeared in Caddell's memo. It was a speech born of panic, as the details of its genesis soon made clear. The product of a 10-day domestic summit meeting, as the press called it, at Camp David earlier in the month. Battalions of advisors and experts from various fields, plus his wife, Rosalyn, barraged the president with advice on how he might reverse declining poll numbers, a perceived erosion of national confidence, and his own image as a leader. It became a question of saving his presidency, an aide admitted to the New York Times soon afterward. I watched the televised talk with mounting incredulousness and outrage. The message was contrary to, it was in conflict with, all the ideals of the Democratic Party that I cherished. It was in conflict with what the country was about. I tried to imagine President Kennedy or Bobby Kennedy ever abandoning their optimism in the face of adversity and giving vent to sentiments remotely this melancholy. If this message was truly reflective of Carter's feelings, I couldn't see how he was really going to address the central problems we were facing, both in the economy and foreign policy. It was in the aftershocks of this speech that I began thinking seriously about running for the presidency in 1980. Inflation, a malady of the past several years, was at double digits now, and the president, in my view, had abdicated his responsibility to deal with this issue. As for health care reform, he had had nearly 3 years to demonstrate the commitment implied by his campaign promises, and had either misrepresented or misstated what that commitment would be. Crowning all these was the overall leadership issue, what the Democratic Party historically stood for, what I had seen it stand for. This president had said that he believed that the spirit of America was in crisis. I recognized that Jimmy Carter, although he was of my own party, held an inherently different view of America from mine. In late August, Ronald Reagan edged ahead of Carter for the first time in the presidential preference polls. Those same polls showed me with a lead over Carter, among Democrats, of 62% to 24%. They also indicated that I would defeat Reagan handily. First, though, there was the matter of actually defeating Jimmy Carter. I believed that I could do this. But even before my campaign officially got started, I ran into some unpromising harbingers. For me, getting up to speed in a political campaign has always taken time. There are many good campaigners who can leave the Senate floor on a late afternoon and be red hot on the campaign trail that night. Not me. It takes me 2 or 3 days to get warmed up and into the mood. For some reason, in 1979 and early 1980, it took even longer than usual for me to get going. One of the most damaging indicators of my sluggish start was the now-famous two-part interview I taped with Roger Mudd of CBS News in September and October 1979. The edited interview ran as an hour-long news special on Sunday night, November 4th, just 3 days before I announced my candidacy. Mudd himself dwells on this interview in his 2008 memoir. He observes correctly that he and I had known one another socially in past years. Because of these connections, Mudd writes, perhaps there was, in 1979, the assumption by the senator and his staff that this would be a softball documentary. He correctly notes that the filming took place weeks before I declared my candidacy. Mudd, as he recalls, wanted 2 sit-down interviews, one at my Cape Cod house, about family and personal matters, and one at my office or at McLean, about senatorial matters. I consented to allow a CBS crew to follow me around for several days, filming me on Capitol Hill, in my office, in Hyannisport, and in other informal situations. I remember the circumstances of that interview a little differently. I recall, for example, that I'd granted the interview to Mudd as a personal favor during a critical moment in his CBS News career. I had run into Roger at the Waldorf Astoria in New York in June of that year, when I attended a reception for the President of Mexico, José López Portillo y Pacheco. As I walked out of the hotel at about 10 p.m., Roger approached me and said, I cannot recall the words verbatim, I'm in this contest with Dan Rather for the anchor position at CBS News, and I'd love to get an interview with your mother. It was common knowledge that Mudd had been expected to replace Walter Cronkite when he hit the age of mandatory retirement at CBS, but Rather was giving him a serious run for his money. I replied, well, my mother doesn't do interviews. She's older and she just isn't up to the demands. But let me think about it and I'll get back to you. Roger said, it would make a big, big difference if I could ever do that interview down at Cape Cod. Everybody's always wanted that interview with your mother. I talked to my mother and my sisters about it. We decided that Mudd could do the interview with Mother as they walked along the beach, but I would have to be with them. The two of them could chat back and forth, but we just didn't want to have a sit-down or to leave Mother on her own. Roger said that was fine. I added, "Our children are going to the Cape, so that's going to be the setting." Roger said that was fine, too. A day or two before the scheduled interview, my mother fell ill and left the Cape for Boston. At about the same time, Kara received an invitation from the Hopi tribe in Arizona, the only matriarchal tribe in the country. They asked her, as one interested in Native American culture, to come there and be a part of a large ceremony they were planning. Kara wanted to go, and so she was out of the interview tableau. And finally, for a reason I can't recall, Teddy said he could not be available either. That left Patrick, who had just turned 12, and me. I telephoned Roger, explained the situation, and tried to put off the interview. "Oh, no," he replied. "That'll be all right. I'll come on down. We'll do you and the sea and Cape Cod and what the sea is meant." I thought I could easily talk about that, how I used the sea as a place of rest and reflection, and what this place meant to me and the family. Roger and his crew arrived and set up for the interview at Squaw Island, the area half a mile west of the Cape House where I owned a seaside cottage. I had asked no staff members to be present, and I had done no preparation for an interview that dealt with political or personal topics. The agreement, as I'd understood it, was that our topic was to be the sea and the connections between the Cape and the Kennedy family. I should have had my political antennae up. In retrospect, it is almost inconceivable to me that I did not. As we took our chairs out in front of the house, the camera rolled and we talked for some 40 minutes about the sea and the Cape. During a break, I looked at the time and said, "That's about it, isn't it?" Mudd replied, "Yes, just about." I turned to my 12-year-old son, who was watching, and said, "Patrick, why don't you go down and get the boat and pick me up? I'll see these people to their van." When Patrick had disappeared, Roger excused himself and consulted with two CBS executives, who'd accompanied him and had stood nearby watching our interview. Then Roger walked back to me and surprised me by asking, "Can we do one more segment?" I replied, "Well, I'd really like to go. I think we've done it." "No," he said, "we'd really like to do just one more." And so I agreed to do one more. Mudd later wrote that he and the other two newsmen had compared notes on the conversation thus far and pronounced it a disaster. The cameraman put in a fresh roll of film and Roger resumed his questions. The first had to do with Chappaquiddick. Then he asked about my marriage. My discomfort and unhappiness with a line of questioning was more than apparent on my face and in my halting answers. I was further distracted by my awareness that Patrick was on the water by himself, struggling with a 25-foot sailboat. I needed to go down there and help him. At last it ended, and the CBS crew packed its equipment. Mudd and I shook hands and they drove away. When Patrick and I were on the water, I told him my sense of the interview. A disaster. I telephoned Mudd the next day and said, "Look, if we're going to do this thing, I want another crack at it." Mudd agreed. Our understanding called for two sessions anyway, and so on October 12th, we sat down again, this time in my Senate office in Washington. The cameraman signaled that the film was rolling, and Roger Mudd asked, "Why do you want to be president?" I had not yet publicly declared my intention to challenge President Carter, and had no intention of announcing my candidacy in this interview with Roger Mudd. I wrestled in my mind with just how far to go. After a long pause, I began, "Well, were I to make the announcement and to run, the reasons I would run is because I have a great belief in this country, that it is, there's more natural resources than any nation in the world. There's the greatest educated population in the world, the greatest technology of any country in the world, the greatest capacity for innovation in the world, and the greatest political system in the world. And yet I see at the current time that most of the industrial nations of the world are exceeding us in terms of productivity and are doing better than us in terms of meeting the problems of inflation. and on in that vein for 336 words, by the courtesy of Roger's own count, of which CBS used the first 242. My displeasure with Roger Mudd unfortunately spilled over into my interview performance. I regret that. If I had already declared my candidacy, I suppose I would have had a more polished answer to Mudd's question, but the essence would have been the same. On November 4, 1979, the same day as the airing of the Mudd interview, Iranian Islamist revolutionaries seized 52 U.S. diplomats at the American Embassy in Tehran. The nation plunged into shock. At the time, none of us could have anticipated that this crisis would continue for 444 days. On Wednesday, November 7th, I went ahead with my plans to announce my candidacy for my party's nomination as President of the United States. As I stood quietly behind the lectern in Faneuil Hall, I was enveloped in the moment. My personal past, my family's past, the Boston past, the American past. It had all coalesced in this room, where patriots had once gathered before the Revolutionary War to shape the American future. Honey Fitz had pointed to this building and told me its stories as we strolled past it on those long-ago Sundays. Jack had made his final 1960 campaign appearance here. I was 47 years old, 1 year older than Jack when he died. Jackie smiled at me from the audience of some 350 friends and relatives, three generations of my family, from my mother to my children, and half again as many reporters. And so now, here I stood. I'd chosen not to make my announcement from the Senate caucus room in Washington, where both Jack and Bobby had delivered theirs. This setting symbolized my wish to be understood not as the third Kennedy brother in a line of succession, but as a candidate entirely of my own volition and purposes. My announcement speech was brief, just a little over 15 minutes. Emphasizing my strong antipathy towards Carter's view of a weakened American spirit, I stressed my belief in the hope and daring that had made the country great, and cautioned against the myth that we cannot move. At the conclusion, to warm applause, I embraced my family, who had joined me at the lectern, and then it was down to business. I hit the campaign trail at once. Jimmy Carter was waiting for me. In fact, he had been cleverly using the power of the presidency to pick off my potential supporters before I even announced. His operatives canvassed work programs around the country that had received operational funding. They told the people in those programs they had to vote for Carter because he could guarantee their funding. They reached out to mayors and local leaders in these towns and cities that were important electorally. They asked these people, "What do you need? What are you asking for?" When I was in Washington just after I announced, the Illinois Congressman Dan Rostenkowski came over and said, "We're going to do the same thing for you in Chicago that we did for John Kennedy. You can relax. You can depend on me to do it." About 10 days later, at a gathering of Democratic congressional leaders at the White House, I spotted Rostenkowski. It seemed that he was avoiding me. I called him up the next day, but I couldn't get him. 4 days later, he announced for Carter, who had pushed through funding for Chicago's transit system. Some of the other supporters I was counting on were simply missing in action. At Eunice's Special Olympics in New York State, Pat Moynihan had made a big point of pulling me over and saying I had to run. He'd said he'd do anything for me. In a New York meeting, Hugh Carey had said the same thing. I had to run. He'd do anything for me. But once my campaign got started, I never heard from either of them again. Then my campaign funding took a serious hit after my defeat in the Iowa caucuses. On January 21, 1980, in our first head-to-head contest, Jimmy Carter won the caucuses by an unexpected 2-1 margin. Iowa was a learning experience for me as a grassroots campaigner. Unfortunately, the lessons I learned came too late. The sluggish start that I mentioned showed up in the initial fuzziness of my message, but it hurt in other ways as well. We were slow in organizing, and the campaign had a jump-start feel in the early weeks. My campaign manager and close friend Steve Smith worked capably, but he was burdened by angst about my safety and the question of adequate security. We were not quick to realize how the hostage crisis had changed the whole electoral atmosphere and strengthened support for the president. My nephew, Joe Kennedy II, later elected as a congressman from Massachusetts, saw the debacle coming. He was the one person on my team who sensed that Iowa was going to be a bigger-than-life state, and that it was not in my pocket despite the good poll numbers. After he visited there, he told us, "This is not a caucus. This is a primary state. There's so much activity and involvement." No one really paid sufficient attention to him. We did Iowa the old-fashioned way, from the top down. We located the state's local Democratic leaders, who were leaning toward us, and counted on them to turn out the voters on caucus night. I made a strenuous tour of the towns, hitting many of them two, even three times. I noticed that the turnouts were not gigantic, quite small in some cases, but attributed that to the thin population. On the evening of January 21st, we counted more Democrats in our column than had shown up in either of the previous two presidential races. I looked at the numbers and said, "I'm going to win this thing. I'm going to win it." I didn't win it. We'd misread that surge of Democrats who favored me. They were a minority faction in one of the largest turnouts in Iowa history, more than 100,000 people, and most of them declared for Carter, by a margin of roughly 60% to 30. I could not believe it at first. I had campaigned with everything I had. I had visited Iowa's cities and towns again and again, Ottumwa, Ames, Cedar Rapids, Davenport, Council Bluffs. What had gone wrong? I finally got the answer from Harold Hughes, the former governor and senator from the state. Hughes was a supporter, but other obligations had kept him away from my campaign. "I'll tell you why you lost," Hughes said. "The reason was, you'd arrive in one of these little towns, and there'd be 100 people waiting for you at the church or the meeting hall. But you'd bring 20 Secret Service agents with you, and they would be pushing people around, telling them to sit over there. And then there would be 30 TV cameras." "Now, when I campaigned in Iowa," Hughes went on, "I would drive into, say, Ames myself, at the wheel of a car or a pickup truck. I'd get out, and I'd go into the meeting hall by myself, and I'd shake everybody's hand and tell them my name. Then I'd write their names down. And after my talk, I would go back to the motel, and I'd take that list of names out, and I'd write a note to everyone on it. That's what you have to do when you campaign in Iowa." Hughes's folksy approach made sense to me. Unfortunately, in my case, it was an impossibility. The Secret Service agents and the mass of TV people were following me around, on the assumption that I was a marked man. And so the heavy Secret Service was assigned, and the television crews were along to preserve it for posterity, should it happen. Was I worried about my physical safety? I suppose so, but I never brooded about it. I could not live my life dwelling on that kind of thing. Threatening letters are regularly sent to my office. We deal with them in a professional way, but I don't read them. I choose not even to know about them unless absolutely necessary. I've decided that I would not live out my life in fear of the shadows. I flew back home from Iowa to McLean, where I listened to the results. When it became clear that Carter had carried the caucuses, I braced myself for a very unhappy duty. I knew I had to call my mother and tell her the bad news, that I was the first Kennedy who had lost an election. Her voice came on the phone, and I broke it to her as gently as I could. And I received one of Rose Kennedy's priceless, endearing reality checks. "Oh, that's all right, Teddy dear," she replied. "I'm sure you'll work hard, and it'll get better." And then, "Teddy, do you know that nice blue sweater I gave you at Christmas time? Do you remember that?" I said I remembered it, yes. It was a turtleneck, and it had a small pocket on the front. It had been made in France. "Have you worn it?" I said, "Well, I'm not sure that I've worn it." She said, "Is there something special about it? because I just got the bill for it and it was $220. Will you check it out, Teddy? And if you haven't worn it, will you send it back? Because I've got another blue one here that I think is just as nice and is not nearly as expensive. By the next morning, I was ready to go into battle again. I was scheduled to speak at Georgetown University in less than a week, on January 28th. I decided that if people were waiting for a strong message, they were going to hear it that night. No more fumbling or fuzziness. From my opening words that night at Georgetown, I took the fight directly to Jimmy Carter. Specifically, I assailed what I saw as the futile stridency in the Carter Doctrine that he'd unveiled 5 days earlier in his State of the Union address. The doctrine was a response to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan on Christmas Eve, 1979, which had triggered shock and anxiety throughout the free world. Citing Carter's remark that he was surprised by the Soviet strike, I pointed to the warning signals that the president had missed. The obvious Russian buildup of forces, and the murder of the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan while Soviet military advisors looked on. I drew attention to the hostage crisis in Iran, the Muslim students' detaining of American diplomats there, in retaliation for the U.S. admission of the deposed Shah for medical treatment, was in its 86th day. This is a crisis that never should have happened, I told the audience, because the administration had been warned of exactly this response to allowing the hated Shah inside our borders. The president considered those warnings and rejected them in secret. Expanding from there, I rebuked the president for his failure to resolve a number of issues affecting ordinary Americans as he groped for a coherent foreign policy. Rising inflation, unemployment, and energy prices. I called for gasoline rationing and for freezes, followed by controls on prices, wages, profits, dividends, interest rates, and rents. Today, I concluded, I reaffirm my candidacy for President of the United States. I intend to stay the course. I believe we must not permit the dream of social progress to be shattered by those whose promises have failed. Press reaction in the following days ratified my sense that the speech had infused my campaign with the snap and focus it had so far lacked. He gave some real reasons for running, based on issues, Anthony Lewis declared to the New York Times of January 31st, and he sounded like a man who wanted to run. Contrary to all doubts that might have arisen at the time or since, I did want to run. I did want to be president. The bad news, though, was that the campaign coffers were running on empty. We were nearly broke. The big money began to fade away after the Iowa caucuses. There were some on my team who wanted it to end. My 200 campaign aides had worked without pay since mid-January. But pay was not the issue for them. They were willing to continue, and did. Their concerns were not for themselves, but for my political future. I can remember Steve Smith telling me on that night, "Look, no money now. We're in debt. If you get out now, no one will really blame you. You took a crack. Your career is still intact. If you go back to the Senate, it's not a real blemish on your record. But if you stay in, I have the poll here from Massachusetts. You're getting beaten by 25 points in your home state. If Carter beats you in Massachusetts, your career is gone. Finished. That's what you're looking at. You have no money, and I don't know what's going to turn this thing around." That was a very tough conversation. I remember walking around outside for a while after Steve spoke his mind. I told him, "I think I'll just wait a couple of days before I make my mind up." After a couple of days, I said, "I'm staying in it." My reasons were not complicated. I genuinely cared about the issues I was running on, and I knew that my team did as well. I felt we could get traction with our message and win some of the upcoming primaries and keep faith with our supporters around the country. There was hardly any shortage of issues to care about in that year: health care, the economy, foreign policy. One frustrating problem in propounding my stand on these issues was simply being heard. I competed for airtime and often lost on the evening news with the Iran hostage crisis and then the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, some in the press continued to raise the issue of Chappaquiddick. We won some, we lost some, we won some more. We were in constant need of funds, but delighted with creative sources. Politically engaged artists created lithographs for us to sell on behalf of the campaign. James Rosenquist, Jamie Wyeth, Andy Warhol, Bob Rauschenberg. These artists probably raised a couple of $1 million for us. They kept us going. As the weeks and months went on, I was able to refine my message in interviews and speeches, yet that did not neutralize the media obstacles to getting that message out on a daily basis. Several times I challenged Carter to a public debate. In late May, I even offered to drop out of the race and release my delegates if the president would debate me before the convention. Carter and his people deflected these offers, perhaps finding it impossible to believe that I would leave the race if my beliefs for the party received an adequate hearing. We broke new ground in campaigning openly for gay rights. Toward the end of the campaign, I was the beneficiary of a fundraiser at the Hollywood Hills home of a couple named Clyde Carnes and John Carlson. As my entourage made its way toward the party, someone informed me that it had been declared off-limits to the news media. I asked all the cars in the caravan to stop while my staff phoned up news outlets in the city and invited them to come along. We were overwhelmed by TV cameras. No major party candidate had ever appeared at a fundraiser organized by gay supporters. I opened up a question-and-answer session at the event, and the complexity of some of the questions really fascinated me. One person wanted to know whether a partner from another country without legal status to remain in the United States would face deportation. Others raised fairness issues about the tax code and health care. I did a lot more listening than answering that night, and left with greater awareness of issues lawmakers were not yet confronting. I met with Carter at the White House on June 5th to discuss the campaign and a way that we might go forward. We sat opposite each other in front of the fireplace, with a vase of flowers between us. I tried to set a formal tone. I told him I certainly understood that mathematically I didn't have the delegates to win the nomination. But I felt that I was representing the concerns of millions of Americans who deserve to have their voices heard. The president had ducked debating me for the entire primary season, and as a result, the people in our own party had been deprived of a give and take on the issues that mattered to them. I said that I was concerned about the economic issues facing our country and wanted to have a public dialogue with him about them. I also said that I was in the process of making decisions about how I was going to proceed in the next few weeks as we move toward the convention, and that what I was most interested in was this dialogue. Finally, I told him that if we had a debate on economic issues and were able to make some progress through good faith, constructive efforts on both our parts, then I would say that I would support the party's nominee. It was a respectful exchange, about 15 minutes. He listened to what I had to say and raised only a few points of contention. After I told him that I was not interested in being divisive, he criticized the harsh tone of my campaign rhetoric and said he had never attacked me personally. I responded, "Mr. President, those ads of yours aren't handling me with kid gloves." At one point he said, "You know, I too grew up in a family that was political, and we were very combative." When I raised the prospect of a debate, Carter asserted that no incumbent had ever debated in the history of our country. "Besides," he said, "people understand our policy differences." Ultimately, his response was, "You present your views to the platform committee, I'll present mine, and we'll stay in touch through our people. No debate." As our conversation drew to a close, he asked me whether there was any part of the campaign I had enjoyed. I said it was least satisfactory when things were electronic rather than person to person. He said he couldn't agree more. The 1980 Democratic Convention was set to begin on August 10th in New York. I maintained my candidacy through the convention so that I could speak to the issues and address the delegates and the people I'd been fighting for. We had been on the trail for 9 months, 100,000 miles, through 40 states, and we were not victorious. but neither were we defeated. Our cause, I declared, was the same as it had been since the days of Thomas Jefferson, the cause of the common man and the common woman. Our commitment had remained, since the days of Andrew Jackson, to all those he called the humble members of society, the farmers, mechanics, and laborers. I spoke out of a deep belief in the ideals of the Democratic Party, I went on, and in the potential of that party and of a president to make a difference. I offered the promise of the dignity of useful work to those who were idle in the cities and industries of America. I called for the re-industrialization of America. I asked for resolution against the risk that prosperity be purchased by poisoning the air, the rivers, and the great natural resources of the continent. I affirmed the need to defeat inflation, reshape the unfair tax structure. And finally, avowing that we cannot have a fair prosperity in isolation from a fair society, I reaffirmed my stand for a national health insurance. We must not surrender to the relentless medical inflation that can bankrupt almost anyone and that may soon break the budgets of government at every level. I congratulated President Carter on his victory and voiced my confidence that the Democratic Party would reunite on the basis of democratic principles. And someday, long after this convention, long after the signs come down and the crowd stop cheering, and the band stop playing, may it be said of our campaign that we kept the faith. For me, a few hours ago, this campaign came to an end. For all those whose cares have been our concern, the work goes on, the cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dream shall never die. The delegates' response was warm and generous. NBC News said they were still cheering after 45 minutes. I didn't know it was that long, but it was gratifying. Our message got through. I returned for the final night of the convention to be on the stage after President Carter's speech. I reached the convention floor shortly after the speech ended, but a whole crowd of other Democrats were already there. The cheering after the speech had not gone as long as some had expected, so the platform was filling up earlier than anticipated. Tip O'Neill was right behind me, and behind him was the former party chairman Bob Strauss, and then Fritz and Joan Mondale, and party leaders of all kinds. I shook the president's hand, and then Mrs. Carter's hand. I did not elevate his hand, and he made no effort to elevate mine. But then the press began to point out that I had not elevated Jimmy's hand, and that became a sore spot that has lasted, I suppose, to this day. I thought what we did on the podium was proper enough. Had he made an effort to raise our hands together, I certainly would not have resisted. It just wasn't a big deal. Certainly it wasn't as if we'd just gone 15 rounds in the ring for a heavyweight championship. President Carter continues to believe that I weakened him for the general election and caused him to lose the presidency to Ronald Reagan. In fact, he makes a point of saying so frequently, especially when he speaks in Boston. But I'm not really sure he needed any help from me. Carter's approval rating in the summer of 1979, before his malaise speech, was 25% lower than Richard Nixon's after Watergate. The nation was suffering through an energy crisis and double-digit inflation. The American people were looking for new leadership, and Ronald Reagan was capturing the imagination of the American people with his sunny optimism. Having said that, President Carter was still quite successful against me. His political strategy worked, and my improvement in the closing weeks was too little, too late. What would have happened had I gained the nomination? Frankly, I don't know that I could have beaten Ronald Reagan. He was more than a candidate at that time. He was a movement. After the election, I phoned President Carter on December 15th, as his administration was nearing its end. He asked me if I was looking forward to the new administration. I answered, "Not one day sooner than they take office." He said he would be staying in the White House until the last possible day. There had been reports that Mrs. Reagan had suggested the Carters should vacate their residence prior to January 20, 1980. I thanked him for nominating the former Senate Judiciary Committee counsel, Stephen Breyer, to the U.S. Court of Appeals. The president said he didn't know Breyer personally, but had heard a lot of good things about him. It wasn't a long conversation. He asked me about Reagan's cabinet nominees, and I said they would not be subject to much dispute, except, possibly, Alexander Haig. We also talked about the status of fair housing legislation and skiing. We both had trips planned for the holidays. Then, we wished each other a Merry Christmas and said we hope to stay in touch.
Chapter 19. The Reagan Years, 1980 to 1988. One of my first encounters with President Ronald Reagan was on St. Patrick's Day in 1981, during a small luncheon at the Irish Embassy. We were seated at the same table. He was warm and friendly, full of laughter and small talk. He told us of his recent meetings with Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, whom he described as a rather lonely man, and Mexican President José López Portillo, who showed Reagan his detailed doodlings of horses, while expressing a desire to become a painter after his term ended. When he was asked about British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, Reagan said, "I hope Senator Kennedy will excuse me here." Then the new president proceeded to tell us how Thatcher had advised him to enact his entire program at once. Otherwise, opponents would nibble away at it. So, he told us, that was what he was going to do. Toward the end of the meal, Reagan was asked whether he planned to travel much for the next 3 years, or whether he would host visitors. "You know, I just don't know the answer to that question," Reagan said. "I never get my schedule until 5 o'clock in the afternoon about what I'm going to do the next day. Here I am, the most powerful man in the country, and my wife has to tell me to take my coat off. But to tell you the honest to gospel truth, I really don't know what I'm doing the next day until I get my schedule at night." Someone at our table said, "Well, you must have some idea." Reagan responded, "Oh, I'm sure they've all got ideas about where to send me traveling or who I'm supposed to see, but, you know..." And then he just smiled and laughed. "To tell you the truth, they just come up and tell me about the trips." The questioner at our table persisted, "Well, does this continue for the next 3 years?" Reagan said, "Well, to tell you the truth, I don't even know the answer to that. I don't know if they do it more in the first year or more in the third year. I'll have to find out more about that." I realized at the outset that Reagan's ascendancy would require a fundamental adjustment of my role in the Senate. For the first time in my career, I found myself in the minority party. More challenging still, many colleagues whom I'd counted as reliably liberal began to move rightward from the issues we had championed together over the years. The action commenced almost at once. In February 1981, Reagan, laying the groundwork for his assault upon the tax code, announced his wish to consolidate 88 federal programs into 7 block grants targeted to states and communities. At the same time, he presented a plan to trim federal spending by 15%. He said he wanted to reduce waste and give local governments more flexibility and control. I thought this was nonsense and came out on the attack. At a glance, it was clear that the powerful petroleum companies were going to be shielded from sacrifice, while the flexibility and control of individual families would shrivel, as states would continue their long-standing habits of spurning the poor, the helpless, and the hungry, especially hungry children. I called on such allies as the liberal Republican Lowell Weicker on the Labor Committee to help me in opposing Reagan's block grant proposals, and we were able to rescue a good deal of federal aid for health and education programs from dilution into block grants, though as in most other areas, we couldn't prevent slashes in spending. Nor could we really stem the full onslaught of the Reagan Revolution, though we fought on every battleground that opened up. The administration's long-anticipated first full-scale offensive commenced in July, with the unveiling and swift enactment of the largest tax cut program in American history. Reagan's Economic Tax Recovery Act of 1981 called for $150 billion in tax reductions over the ensuing 3 years, and the president made clear that he would comb the federal budget for corresponding cuts in social, if not military, programs. I voted against this bill, one of a handful of senators to do so, and immediately launched out on a series of speeches and position papers excoriating its likely social effects. It was scorched earth economics, and it would vitiate job training, elementary school education, unemployment compensation, cancer research, and science research in general, as it would cripple the National Science Foundation. Several months later, when these programs had indeed begun to achieve these effects, I groused to a meeting of Democratic loyalists that Ronald Reagan must love the poor. He is making so many of them. My objections to President Reagan's policies are far too vast to enumerate, but one of them seemed to me to be based more on science fiction than reality, and it required us to spend enormous sums of money that might otherwise have gone to addressing our domestic needs. On March 23, 1983, the president took to the prime-time airwaves, raised the terrible specter of the Soviet Union launching a nuclear attack on America, and then asked, "What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies?" This was the world's introduction to Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, on which, a few weeks later, I hung the nickname by which it would be known, Star Wars. I admit it, I had gone to see the movie. At the time, I'd seen the evening as an escape from reality. The idea was that the scientific community would turn their great talents now to the cause of mankind and world peace, and give us the means of rendering these nuclear weapons impotent and obsolete. Then we could change the course of human history. I will avoid a long recitation of what the scientific community was expected to create, the extended-range interceptors and exo-atmospheric re-entry vehicle interception systems, and X-ray lasers and chemical lasers, and neutral particle beams and the rest. Suffice it to say that although some of the technologies developed in the pursuit of this notion proved useful in other anti-ballistic missile applications, Star Wars never quite got off the ground. In 1993, President Clinton significantly trimmed back its scope and budget and renamed it the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization. It's now known as the Missile Defense Agency. One legacy of the budget trimming Reagan's vision is a continuation of space-based defense research that has totaled well in excess of $100 billion. But unlike the movie its nickname evokes, Reagan's Star Wars never really had a successful sequel. On the question of American diplomacy in Northern Ireland, Reagan and I found a reason for some agreement. Reagan traced his ancestry to the village of Ballyporeen in County Tipperary and visited there in the summer of his re-election campaign. There was continued violence in Northern Ireland and, in my view, an underappreciation of the need to stop the violence on both sides of the conflict. We drafted a series of statements and got them out to Senate and House members of both parties to keep their awareness high. Tip O'Neill was very strong. He began a series of speakers' lunches and invited President Reagan to attend. At the same time, a number of us persuaded the Taoiseach, the Irish head of state, and other key officials that this was the time for them to come to the United States. One incentive was that they would have an opportunity to talk with President Reagan about policy, most likely at the speaker's lunch, and so they began coming. Reagan did not discuss policy at these lunches. That clearly was not his intention. The first few times he came, his aides told all of us very clearly that we were simply there to tell funny stories. Reagan would lead off by telling a couple of tales, and then Tip would call on people around the room. At first, the president only called on the Americans at the table. Our Irish guests must have wondered what they were doing there. But gradually, as time went on, he would call on some of the Irish. They would dutifully tell their stories, but they'd also manage to sneak in some comments about the situation in the North. Eventually, those lunches evolved into occasions for serious talk about substantive issues. They became an important and significant framework for dialogue and continue today. Just as important, the luncheons helped motivate Reagan to prevail on his close friend, Margaret Thatcher, to somewhat soften her stance toward the Catholic minority in Northern Ireland. Thatcher had coldly responded to the hunger strike of 1981, but in 1985, she signed the Anglo-Irish Agreement, which gave the Republic of Ireland a role in the affairs of Northern Ireland for the first time. Tip O'Neill privately joked with me that he doubted Reagan was really Irish because he would never take any of his kidding. Once, Tip ran into the president at a party to celebrate the launch of USA Today. Tip said to him, "Why don't you give me a call sometime, Mr. President, and have me come on down? I'll straighten out all those mistakes that you've made in the past 2 years." Tip was just joking, but he could see Reagan's fists getting clenched. On a personal level, I found myself among the countless people who enjoyed Reagan's company. In November 1981, I accompanied my mother and Ethel Kennedy to a White House visit with President and Nancy Reagan to express appreciation for a medal given to Ethel in memory of Bobby. In the car on the way over to the White House, I showed Mother a gift I intended to give to the Reagans, some of Jack's handwritten notes about football and politics. Mother was more concerned with knowing the whereabouts of the medal, in case she was asked any questions about it. When we entered the Oval Office, the president said to Mother, "I'm sure you recognize the desk over there." Mother said, "What about it?" "That's President Kennedy's desk," Reagan said, "with the little doors where John played." The president seemed genuinely interested in Jack's handwritten notes as I read parts to him. Then he said he had a gift for us too, but that it wasn't nearly as nice or personal. He presented us with a jar of jelly beans, noting the improvements in the quality of the candy in recent years. They used to taste a little bit different according to the colors, he told us, but now there were jelly beans that tasted like steak and peas and other sophisticated flavors. "You can reach into a jar and pick up a whole meal," he joked. Mrs. Reagan added, "I wish we had bought stock in the company." He lit up a room, and he could summon laughter, intentionally or otherwise. In fact, sometimes it was hard to tell whether his whimsical side was intentional. The best example of this were the times we met in the Oval Office to discuss whether to protect the American shoe industry from imports and ended up discussing shoes. The question of import quotas on consumer products was a critical issue in the 1980s. Massachusetts was among the states whose industries were struggling the hardest to compete with the flow of cheap foreign goods. Our shoe and textile industries especially were hurting. I was involved in drawing up legislation to curb imports on these products. My bill, like the 200-odd similar bills floating around Congress, was strongly opposed by the White House. Reagan, in fact, vetoed 2 quota bills during his presidency, even as shoe imports soared toward a 90% penetration of the market. Several senators and I asked to speak with the president to press our cases, and he agreed to a meeting. About 10 of us were on hand. John Danforth, the Missouri Republican whose state was hemorrhaging its small shoe plants and who favored some quotas, was present, as was the Missouri Governor Kit Bond. Strom Thurmond sat glowering as a defender of free enterprise to the bitter end. The president's response to our various presentations, everyone felt, could go far in determining the future of his administration's policy, and so we were all steeped in preparation. The president strode briskly into the Oval Office with his famous arm-swinging gait after we'd all arrived, and took a seat right next to me. His aides told us we would have half an hour, total, to present our cases. John Danforth was chosen to go first. He got only as far as, "Good morning, Mr. President." Reagan was looking at me. He said, "Ted, you've got shoes on, haven't you?" I replied truthfully, "Yes, I do, Mr. President." He studied them and said, "They look like Bostonians." I glanced down at the shoes on my feet. Bostonians. I wasn't sure. Why hadn't I checked the label on my shoes before I put them on that morning? But the president was moving on ahead. "Bostonians," he repeated. "That's incredible. Do they still make the Bostonian shoes around here?" I had no idea, but I ventured, "I believe so, Mr. President." Reagan seemed to want hard facts. "Does anybody know where the Bostonian shoes are made?" he demanded of the gathering at large. Kit Bond cleared his throat and said, "I know they produce shoes just like them down in Missouri." Someone else said, "You know, you can get the best shoes, shoes that are better than those shoes, if you come on up to Maine. They've got good shoes up there." Reagan said, "They do have good shoes up there, don't they? Do they give them a real good polish?" "Yes, Mr. President, they give them a good polish." Reagan said, "You know, my father owned a shoe store, and I used to sell shoes, so I know all about them. To measure the length of the foot, you go across the top like this." He began to demonstrate how to measure people's feet for shoes. "You can also put them in the foot measurer, and you turn the knob like this until you know exactly what shoe size will fit. And then to break them in, you take the heel in one hand and the toe in the other, and you push toward the middle. That gets the leather to soften and bend, you see." He went on in this vein for 20 minutes. Several of us began conspicuously to glance at our watches. At some point, I tried politely to intervene. "Mr. President, we've only got, while you're here, we'd like a chance to..." "Well, Ted, it's been a wonderful meeting, and I hope we can continue this discussion at another time. I really enjoyed it. Thank you, and do come again." And it was over. No one ever got a word in about shoe or textile quota legislation. The 10 of us got up and walked out of the White House like goofballs to face the 30 or so TV reporters who wanted to know what sort of progress we'd made on the issue. A larger assemblage met in the Cabinet Room to address the same topic on June 15, 1981. This time the gathering was about equally divided between Republicans and Democrats. Vice President Bush was present, and also Secretary of State James Baker, Secretary of the Treasury Donald Regan, and several others. This time the focus was on the Orderly Markets Agreement put into place 3 years earlier to limit shoe imports by Taiwan and Korea. The Trade Commission had indicated that the limit should continue on Taiwan, but not Korea, because the imports of the latter were no longer a serious competitive threat to the United States. When my turn to speak came, I told the president that what we were arguing for, essentially, was a continuation of the status quo. We felt that the status quo, combined with the administration's new tax program, would motivate the American shoe industry to invest in expansion, which would provide more employment. I also stressed that we were not looking for long-term arrangements, just temporary measures to stabilize the shoe industry over the short haul. Senator William Cohen of Maine began his presentation in a way that might connect with Reagan's sense of humor. He said he remembered the time when Nikita Khrushchev banged a shoe on the podium at the United Nations to emphasize a point. "We want to make sure," Cohen went on, "that Americans were going to keep on having shoes in case they ever wanted to follow a similar procedure." Turning serious for a moment, Cohen emphasized the importance of the shoe industry to Maine and said he just received word of 2 additional shoe plants shutting down in the state. Paul Tsongas and Robert Byrd followed with closely reasoned, emphatic arguments. A couple of others spoke, and then we sat back and awaited Ronald Reagan's response. He said, well, the fact is that he asked about cowboy boots. He wanted to know whether cowboy boots would be protected. Then, after getting some assurance on this point, Reagan told all of us that he was particularly interested in this issue. He was interested because his father had owned a shoe store, and so he, President Reagan, had always thought when he was a young man that the sign of really having made it in the world was wearing a pair of Bostonians. He wondered whether there was still a Bostonian company going. This time I'd done my homework. I told him there was. On those occasions when one did manage to get Reagan to focus on the issue at hand, the net results could be about the same, just a little bit maddening. In that same month of June, I secured another meeting with the president to discuss gun control. I began assuring him that I just wanted to make a few points very quickly because I knew his time was limited. I told him that I'd grown up in a family that did not own guns, but I respected families that do, and I respected the gun tradition in rural America. I hoped, I said, that we could make some progress on gun control with respect to the types of weapons that really had no sporting purpose whatsoever. I wanted to work with his administration, I told Reagan, to eliminate some of the terrible gun problems in this country. Sentencing for gun crimes was one issue of interest to me. Another was one that had worked well in the president's home state of California, a 21-day waiting period to allow background checks on a firearm purchaser that would help keep guns out of the hands of psychopaths. To put a waiting period into federal law might make some sense, and it would amount to a compromise if gun opponents, in return, would be willing to put less emphasis on the manufacture and distribution of certain weapons. President Reagan nodded and looked thoughtful. He said that he had thought about the gun issue for some time. Yes, it was true. In California, they had a good law, mandatory sentencing. But those legislators in California had written into the law an exception for extraordinary circumstances that could mean everything under the sun. They'd just taken the heart out of that law. Yes, something more has to be done out in California. I said that that was interesting. This waiting period, I went on carefully, that might help. Well, Reagan replied, what would happen? Suppose we passed a national law that required the states to have a waiting period. I don't like mandating the states to have this waiting period. But if we did, then what would we do in the 21 days? Would we have to ask Washington to set up a whole new bureaucracy to review all these gun applications? If someone wants to buy a handgun in Mississippi, does that mean Washington is going to make the judgment whether that person can or cannot make the purchase? I said, what about running these matters through local law enforcement and let them make the judgment? Well, Reagan said, then we're still mandating it at the federal level. I think that setting up a whole new kind of process and whole new regulations is not wise. It would be very good if the states did that on their own, of course, and we ought to encourage them to. Then Reagan reflected some more and went on. But you know, there have never really been definitive studies linking the availability of guns and deaths. And I'm just not sure that if we banned Saturday night specials, we'd be doing very much about the problem. There's a study being done by a foundation out on the West Coast that shows it isn't just Saturday night specials. It's handguns in general. Reagan cited the example of Great Britain, where, as he told it, they had a presumption that if you were carrying a gun, you were going to use it. They tried you with the presumption that you had the intent to kill somebody. So it was a very strict law over there. the burglars didn't carry guns, and you didn't have as many shootings. That, President Reagan pointed out, is a different concept than we have over here. But that's what happens in Great Britain. I responded that I knew other countries had other laws, but what I was interested in, I repeated, was reaching some common ground on the gun issue in America. Well, Reagan said, I think it's difficult to mandate to the states any kind of requirement. I heard the door to the Oval Office open behind me and felt the presence of someone who had walked in and was standing behind me. It was a signal that my time with the president was up. This conversation took place about 2 months after John Hinckley stepped from a crowd outside a Washington hotel and fired a shot that ricocheted into President Reagan's lung with a German-made Saturday Night Special that was traced to a pawn shop in Dallas. Hinckley struck two others with the shots he fired. The pistol contained 6 foreign-made explosive cartridges, illegal in the United States. None of the shells exploded. Had the bullet struck the president directly, he could easily have been killed. Reagan could be warmly gracious. He offered an eloquent tribute to Jack's memory in a 1985 fundraiser to endow the John F. Kennedy Library, held at my home in McLean. It was a wonderful evening. When the president arrived, he took special care to talk to the children in attendance and posed for individual photos with them. There was a joke about where to stand, and Reagan remarked how important such directions were, particularly in the movies, because if you didn't hit your mark, it could upset the whole scene. Many times, he said, scenes were ruined because an actor would start off on the left foot instead of the right. Caroline and Jackie were in attendance. Jackie seemed somewhat surprised when Caroline asked the president whether he had any microphones in the Oval Office. Reagan denied it, but Caroline said she thought she had detected one on a previous visit.